everything I've said into something that Simon said, or vice versa, because every single statement does correspond. Okay, I should say this is based on work I've done with my collaborators Lionel Mason, Matthew Bullimore, and Tim Adamo. Now, throughout various conferences, this conference and the previous ones, we've seen that twisters have been useful in a variety of computations in 4D gauge theories. Of course, there's a long history of this. It goes back to Penrose, it goes back to Atiyah, Drinfeld, Hitchin, Manin, and Richard Ward, various people. But in particular, they've been especially useful in N equals 4 super young mills, and at various points in many people's calculations, they find it useful to translate their answers into twisters. Now, there are two reasons why twisters turn out to be useful, and we'll explore both of them in a minute. The first reason, the most obvious reason, is that twister space carries a very natural action of the space-time conformal group. Unlike momentum space, which isn't acted on geometrically by the special conformal generators, for example, twister space, there's a very straightforward geometric action of the conformal group on twister space. And the second reason twisters are useful, which in some ways is deeper, is that the twister data for scattering processes, or null polygonal Wilson loops in particular, is unconstrained. Again, we'll see exactly what that means in just a minute. Now, because of these simplifications, as I say, many groups have made use of twisters at some point during their calculation, but the sort of general philosophy of the group that I've been working with has been to take advantage of these simplifications as soon as possible in the calculation, rather than compute in space-time and then realize that your answer looks pretty if you turn it into twisters. Can we compute the thing just using twisters from the start? The answer for that is going to be yes, and I'll explain how to do it. In particular, I'm going to focus on the same duality between scattering amplitudes and Wilson loops that Simon talked about, and we'll see that it's immediate to generalize this duality, which was first known just for MHV amplitudes, into the supersymmetric sector so that you get the full super amplitude for the duality. This is exactly what Simon talked about, but I think even he'll admit that handling the supersymmetry is much easier if you do it in twister space. Okay, so let's start out with the basics. What is twister space? Twister space is a copy of complex projective 3 space, so it's described by 4 homogeneous coordinates, two component complex spinners, defined up to an overall scaling relation. We can rescale lambda and mu by a non-zero complex constant, and the point in twister space stays the same. And as I mentioned, it has a very natural action of the conformal group, or its complexification, just acting modulo overall rescalings. It acts just by straightforward complex linear transformations on these coordinates. Now, how does this correspond to space-time? Well, the basic picture is that a point x here in space-time corresponds to a Riemann sphere, which I'll draw as a complex line, in twister space, a linearly embedded Riemann sphere in twister space, which I'll call capital X. And a point, conversely, in twister space, this red dot Z here, corresponds, at least in Minkowski signature, to a light ray, with the fact that this point is on this light ray, the fact that this point lies on the line X means that this light ray goes through the point X. It's part of the null cone through the origin of X. So in particular, this null cone, if we take a cross-section, is just a two-sphere, and that labels all the light rays that are on this line X. In particular, if we've got some other point Y that's null separated from X in space-time, that means we've got another line Y in twister space which intersects X, the line X, because they share a light ray represented by this point Z. In particular, we can say this in equations. Mu and lambda here are our twister coordinates. So the incidence relations tell us that if mu is equal to lambda, X times lambda, where X defines which line we're talking about, and at the same time, the same point mu lambda is equal to the same point, the same twister Z is related as mu equals Y lambda for some other line Y, then subtracting these two equations, you find that the difference between X and Y dotted into lambda vanishes, and so X and Y must be proportional to lambda, and so it's null. Now, The history of twister space goes back to the Penrose transform, the first useful thing that was done with it, which was Penrose gave a very nice construction of all free fields for arbitrary helicities, for massless free fields on twister space. They're simply described by elements of this cohomology group, which is nothing scary at all. Locally, it's described just by a completely arbitrary holomorphic function of a certain homogeneity under the scaling relation of the twister coordinates, where the homogeneity is just whatever the number that appears in these brackets is. And Penrose showed, together with his collaborators later on, that this cohomology group, all the elements of this cohomology group are completely equivalent to all solutions, analytic solutions, of the wave equation for the massless free field. For you get the appropriate wave equation for the appropriate helicity, depending on what homogeneity of function you do. The important point here is that you can pick any holomorphic function, as long as it's got the right scaling property. You can pick a totally arbitrary holomorphic function. That's rather similar to on-shell momentum space. You know that you can write an arbitrary function on the mass shell in momentum space, and that will satisfy, once you do an integral transform, that will satisfy the space-time field equation. The same is going to be true here. An arbitrary function that's holomorphic in twister space, once we do some integral transform, will give us any solution of the field equation in space-time. But the advantage over momentum space is, as we said before, that we've got this nice action of the conformal group. Okay, so just to see how this works in detail, if we take a scalar field on space-time, so h is 0, and so the homogeneity of the function has to be minus 2, you just multiply it by lambda d lambda, which is the natural measure on the line x in twister space that corresponded to the point x in space-time, and integrate the two things. The homogeneity of lambda d lambda here is balanced by the homogeneity of this function. And this will give you some function. Since this depends on z, but we restricted mu equals x lambda and integrated out lambda, this will give us some function of x. But the point is, if this thing was holomorphic, then this thing automatically obeys the field equation. To see that, just act with the Dell inversion. This differentiates. The only x dependence is inside here, but this field only depends on x through its dependence on mu, so we can replace this operator d by dx squared by lambda d by d mu squared, and precisely because these indices are contracted with the SL2C invariant epsilon tends to the 2 index epsilon symbol, this thing is automatically zero. The fact that we could replace d by dx by just lambda d by d mu was a consequence of this being holomorphic. Now, so holomorphic fields on twister space, or more properly elements of these cohomology groups, correspond to on-shell fields, but we can write an action in twister space very easily whose field equation simply is that the field should be holomorphic. So for example, for a massless scalar field, we just take this to be the field equation for the twister field phi. And you can show, indeed, that this action reduces, after some particular choices, this action reduces exactly to the standard free massless field equation, free massless field action in space-time. Now, so far, this is all for free fields. It's rather dull, but of course, it's the right thing for external data in a scattering amplitude. But historically, the next step was the Penrose-Ward construction, which generalized, instead of considering holomorphic functions, considered holomorphic vector bundles over twister space. And so instead of just getting solutions to free field equations, when you turn that back into something on space-time, you found you got an arbitrary solution to the self-dual Yang-Mills equations. And, of course, this was famously used by ADHM in their construction of all instantons. Now, in this talk, we're interested in n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, so let's write an action on twister space that corresponds to n equals 4 super Yang-Mills. It's got two parts. The first part is a holomorphic Chern-Simons theory. It's written not now on just bosonic twister space, but fully supersymmetrically, it's written on super twister space. So in particular, I've added 4 fermionic coordinates to my twisters, and that's what this integral here means, an integral over both the bosonic parts and the fermionic parts. And I've just got the standard holomorphic Chern-Simons action, except that the field here is now a super field. So it's got a component expansion in these fermions here, starting with something of homogeneity 0 and going down to a component field of homogeneity minus 4 so as to balance these fermions in front. So the equations of motion, if we turn off this extra piece, this piece proportional to the Yang-Mills coupling squared, then the equations of motion for holomorphic Chern-Simons just tell you that the 0,2 part of the curvature, so the curvature of A with both form indices in anti-holomorphic directions vanishes, and that means we have a holomorphic vector bundle on twister space. That was exactly the situation of the Penrose-Ward construction, and so that exactly corresponds to self-dual fields on space-time. Of course, that's part of the action that Simon started with as well. But the purpose of this extra term here is to complete the action beyond self-dual theory to full super Yang-Mills on space-time. In particular, if we expand out in powers of the of the field A here, we can replace this log depth by an infinite series of terms, or with arbitrary numbers of these fields inserted, and connected up by inverse D bar operators, by free fermion propagators, if you wish, on a Riemann sphere. So there's a whole bunch of insertions of A, and they're all connected up by these propagators. These things are an infinite sum of MHV vertices. We're integrating over 8 fermions here. Each A individually only has up to 4 fermions, so to saturate this integral, if we just consider the gluons, which with positive helicity reside here and negative helicity reside here, then we need precisely two of these negative helicity gluons, but arbitrarily many. It costs us nothing to have as many of these fields as we like. And so we get an infinite sum of MHV vertices. And indeed, just by picking a particular gauge on twister space, you can exactly show that this action reduces precisely to the Chalmers and Siegel form of the action, the N equals 4 CPN Mills action that Simon was talking about before. Okay, so let's use this to compute something. The first thing to compute is scattering amplitudes. But before we can really compute anything, we need to know what the propagator is for that holomorphic Chern Simons theory. Now, that's really best understood in context. There are several objects in twister theory which are going to be important. The simplest is just a delta function, saying that two twisters have to be at the same point. Okay? The trouble is we can't just say that Z1 equals Z2 because they were only defined up to an overall scaling. So instead, we ask that Z1 is some multiple of Z2, but we don't care what the multiple is. We integrate over the scalar multiple, and we choose the measure to make sure that this has zero homogeneity in both Z1 and in Z2. This delta bar here is just because these are complex variables, so really I just mean d bar of one of it, or delta of its real part and delta of its imaginary part. Okay, so similarly, we can add in two twisters here, each with their own scaling parameters, and integrate over both. And this tells us that non-projectively, Z1 must lie on the plane through the origin spanned by Z2 and Z3, or projectively, it just tells us that they live on a line. And it's usually better to work with these expressions directly, but you can, if you want, just get standard expressions that are perhaps more familiar out of them. So, for example, if we choose to separate out the lambda components of this delta function from the mu components, we can do these two bosonic integrals using the lambda components, and what's left is exactly this form, which starts to look already like the MHV three-point amplitude. You can carry on by adding more twisters in, and finally you get to something where you've added in an extra 4 twisters compared to, you have something that depends on 5 twisters with 4 scaling parameters, 4 free scaling parameters, each integrated over. The 4 delta functions now balance exactly these 4 integration parameters, and so you get something with no delta functions left, and in fact this thing turns out to be the basic superconformal R invariance. This is exactly what it is in twister space. It's also a very baby example of the Grassmannian formula that Nima talked about. Now, these delta functions are based on relations. If we take d bar of them, then that takes you up the chain in the direction I've been doing. So d bar of something lower down takes you to the one higher up. And with some sign where you sequentially drop one of the arguments as you go up, summed over all possible terms. In particular, that tells you that d bar of delta 2/4 is delta 3/4. Okay, but that's exactly what we want for our propagator. We wanted the kinetic term in the Chern-Simons was the d bar operator, so our propagator was the object that when I hit it with d bar gave me a delta function. So the propagator must be one of these, at least in a certain gauge, the propagator between two points Z and Z prime is exactly this delta 2/4 object where there's an extra argument Z star, which is just our choice of axial gauge. Okay, and indeed it satisfies exactly what you want of a propagator up to some spurious poles to do with the choice of axial gauge. Well, now we've got the propagator, we can compute some diagrams. The simplest thing is just the MHV diagram, which was already present in the action. If you put in some external states that are localized at definite twisters, you find that this is famously, as Nair first pointed out, this is just the statement that all of these things lie on a line. So when written in terms of these delta bar 2/4s, which are manifestly superconformal invariant, just through their definition, fully superconformal invariant, you just find that it's a constraint that says Z1, Z2, Z3 lie on the line, Z1, Z3, Z4 lie on the line, so 4 lies on the same one as 1, 2, and 3, et cetera, all the way up. And if you transform this back to momentum space, you get the usual part Taylor amplitude. But it's easier to do the calculations just straightforwardly in twister space. For example, let's look at the next simplest example, just the NMHV tree. Well, what we're supposed to do is take two MHV vertices and join them up with a propagator. In twister space, each of these MHV vertices lives on a line, just like that, and our twister propagator is exactly this delta bar 2/4 between the point z and the point z prime that we're joining up. So because the MHV amplitudes themselves are just a product of delta functions, it's very easy to do these integrals. We've got two delta functions here. We can arrange it so that z appears just in the last slot of one of these delta functions and also in the last slot by cyclicity of one of these delta functions. So we'll end up with exactly six delta functions and allow us to do these six bosonic integrals. We'll have actually 12 fermionic delta functions, just 8 fermionic integrals. So we'll be left with an object that's got no bosonic delta functions and 4 fermionic delta functions, and not surprisingly, it turns out to be exactly the R invariants. So the amplitudes in twister space are exactly the same R invariants that you see in dual twister space, together with some statements that tell you about the configuration of points they lie on. Okay, so much for amplitudes. Let's move on to Wilson loops. Well, this story has been said many times. I probably don't need to say it. So the story started at strong coupling with Aldo Maldacena performing a t-duality on the type 2B string that they wanted to extract the scattering amplitude from. And they found that you simply needed to compute the area of a minimal surface bounded by some null polygon in a dual copy of spacetime. Inspired by the strong coupling results, people looked at the same thing at weak coupling, and again they found agreement with the scattering amplitude. In particular, they found agreement with the two-loop six-particle amplitude, where there had been a conjectured answer by Bern, Dixon, and Smirnov for what all NMHV amplitudes should look like, and the first place it could, in principle, break down was two-loop six particles, and indeed that ansatz did break down, but the duality between Wilson loops and scattering amplitudes did not break down. However, the calculations of, on the one hand, the scattering amplitude and the Wilson loop on the other hand, look very different. You have totally different Feynman diagrams than the normal way of doing things. It's very hard to see why these things should continue to hold. Also, for the usual Wilson loop, the non-supersymmetric Wilson loop, just the trace autonomy of the connection around the null polygon, you only find MHV amplitudes. So we'd like to know whether we can do it for the full amplitudes, exactly as Simon was explaining, but we'd also like to know why the duality is really holding. And to do that, we're going to look at it in twister space. So this null polygon in space-time becomes a bunch of intersecting lines in twister space. You see, this point here, xn, corresponds to some line xn in twister space. This point x1 corresponds to some other line in twister space. And the fact that these two are null separated just means that these two things intersect here, and so on around the polygon. But the advantage of the twister picture is that we can draw this picture by just labeling the vertices, just picking arbitrary points, n arbitrary points in twister space, and joining them up sequentially. The fact that because we join them up sequentially, neighboring lines will automatically intersect just by construction. That will correspond to them being null separated in space-time, which on the amplitude side will ensure that your external states are massless. But it'll be important to us that we can vary the location of these without constraints. If you try to vary the vertices of the space-time polygon, you have to make sure that you vary it in such a way that you stay null separated from your neighbors. Here you just vary them at will. Well, that's the geometry. What's the object that we wish to compute? Well, we're going to compute a sort of holomorphic, a twister version of the Wilson loop. So we have a superfield in twister space, which is this gauge field A here. And just like for a parallel propagator along a real curve, along any one of these twister lines, x, we can find a unique solution, something that's covariantly constant, subject to some boundary condition. Okay, so this thing, which I'll call u, it obeys all the usual properties despite being defined on a Riemann sphere here. So in particular, it obeys this concatenation property. It's swap the order of the arguments, you get the inverse, and it behaves as you'd expect under a gauge transformation. So it literally just tells you how to compare gauge-valued objects here with gauge-valued objects at some other point on the line. And of course, its value depends on the line that you picked. And just as a piece of notation, we can formally write this exactly as a sort of path-ordered exponential along the line, except that what we mean by path-ordering here is a little bit more subtle. Normally, what you mean is that you put your points in order along a real curve, and you can express that by using some step functions to label the arguments of your insertion points. The reason the step functions come out is precisely because they're the Green's functions for the normal bare derivative operator, d, not d bar. Okay. Here, instead of the real derivative operator, we've got this anti-holomorphic derivative operator. And so we want the Green's function for this d bar operator, which explicitly is so omega as a function of sigma is explicitly d sigma. Sigma 2 minus sigma 1, for example. Sigma 2 minus sigma. Sigma minus sigma 1. Okay, so it has a couple of poles, one at sigma equals sigma 2, one at sigma equals sigma 1, and the location of these poles is supposed to be correlated with the insertion points of the gauge field. That's what the path ordering means in our context. So then we just go ahead. We just take the normal expression for the Wilson loop with this thing, with the full superfield inside here now, and compute its expectation value in the twister action for n equals 4 super Young Mills. Okay, so let's just do the first couple of examples explicitly. So the simplest thing you can do is just stretch a twister propagator between two edges, integrated up and down the edges. Okay, so there's a 1, then summed over all edges with a factor of a half because of double counting, all we have is this twister operator integrated over the two edges. These integration factors are precisely this omega that we've pulled down from the path integral when I write it in coordinates adapted to where S is a coordinate along here and T is a coordinate along here, with this being the point S equals 0 and this being the point S equals infinity. That turns into precisely this measure here. But again, this thing is just the twister propagator. It's just one of those delta bar 2/4s. It's got two bosonic delta functions, so we can instantly do these two integrals, and you immediately find an R invariant. You immediately find the R invariant that depends on your choice of axial gauge and the two pairs of adjacent twisters that define these lines. Now, this is strictly true for generic diagrams where we're far separated. These edges these two edges don't intersect each other. As Belitsky, Korchemsky, and Sokachev pointed out, you need to be much more careful. There are also diagrams here where the propagators stretch between two adjacent edges, and they're in danger of blowing up at the vertex. You can handle that. You can handle that by framing the Wilson loop, in other words, by taking two copies of the Wilson loop slightly separated from one another and considering the propagator stretch between the two pairs. And then these unwanted diagrams, things that don't correspond to anything in the scattering amplitude, vanish in the limit that you first compute this with some shift, and then, having computed it and got a finite quantity, take that shift away. So if we carry on this way, in axial gaze, first of all, just using the holomorphic Chern Simons, keeping the log depth turned off, just looking at order g to the 0, the Wilson loop are exactly the planar duals of the CSW diagrams that we had for the scattering amplitude. You see, this diagram here stretches, if we go back to the space-time picture, it stretches between the line xi and the line xj. It's exactly a propagator between these two points in space-time, and then there's a whole bunch of other points, the other edges of this Wilson loop, that we're not using, so another bunch of points here. And indeed, if you draw the planar dual of that diagram, you find exactly the diagram with the same expression that we saw before that contributes to the scattering amplitude. You carry on for more numbers of particles, again, you find exactly one-to-one correspondence, diagram by diagram, between diagrams in the Wilson loop and diagrams, MHV diagrams, for the scattering amplitude. So as Simon already mentioned, the complete classical S matrix, all tree amplitudes in the theory, from the point of view of the Wilson loop, they're coming from the expectation value of the Wilson loop just in holomorphic Chern Simons theory, just in the theory that corresponds to self-fuel Young Mills. How much time do I have? So to go beyond just the tree amplitudes, we have to turn on this extra term in the action, this sum of MHV vertices. That's where the coupling constant depends on. And so every time we turn that on, because this is integrated over some line x in twister space, we have a new line, not part of the Wilson loop, whose location will be integrated over, and that's exactly a vertex insertion in space-time or the loop integral in the amplitude. Now, because the minimum number of fields we can extract out of this expression is 2, because we need to saturate these 8 fermionic integrals, and recall the field only went up to 4th order in the fermions. So we need at least 2 propagators to connect to this new line. And if you do exactly just this simplest case, you find indeed the expression for the integrand of the one loop MHV amplitude. Again, you continue on, and again the diagrams for the Wilson loop are exactly planar dual to the MHV diagrams for the scattering amplitude. So here, this new line X that we connected to from this vertex corresponds to some new region whose location is integrated over, and these two propagators just join up this location to distinguished two propagators in the MHV diagram. In particular, if you call on this vertex L times, then you'll get a contribution to the L loop amplitude. Summing over all ways of connecting them up, you'll get the integrand of the full L loop amplitude. So we did various numbers of checks beyond MHV level, first at tree level, and then at loop level. And again, diagram by diagram, this correspondence was always holding. Still, although these are nice checks, they're still case by case. You know, maybe it breaks down if we go high enough in loop order. So it's much nicer to have a reason for why the duality is holding. And again, Simon has already alluded to this point with factorization, so let's look at what this means in twister space. So what we did there was we imagined trying to do BCFW recursion on the Wilson loop. BCFW recursion is a natural thing to do on scattering amplitudes. What you do, as everybody here knows, is vary the external momenta in such a way that the momentum remains conserved and all the external particles remain null as you do this variation with respect to some complex parameter Z. Okay. In terms of the contour of the Wilson loop, of course, if you're varying the external momenta, then you're varying the shape of the Wilson loop. But you're keeping it as a null polygon precisely because you're keeping momentum conserved and you're keeping it massless. So you're keeping neighboring edges massless. That's a difficult thing to do in space-time. That's a constraint. You have to obey the constraints that as you vary it, your points remain null separated from their neighbors. But in twister space, as we saw, you just vary these points freely. In particular, if you want to do the standard sort of 1n BCFW shift, that's the most common one to do, it corresponds to taking this point Zn and just translating it along the line towards Zn minus 1. So that this line that used to go from 1n now sweeps out a plane. Now, given that we're varying the contour of a Wilson loop, the natural thing to look at is how the Wilson loop changes when you vary its curve. In other words, let's look at the loop equations. So if you had a real Wilson loop, all you'd have is an insertion of the curvature, insertion of the field strength, the place where you do the variation. You can check that if you vary this sort of twister Wilson loop, this holomorphic Wilson loop, you get an expression that's basically the same thing. Again, you get a copy of the trace from x to x or from z to z all around the curve times the component of the field strength inserted. But because we're varying the curve holomorphically, it turns out that only the 0-2 form parts of the curvature, again, the same things that were the equations of motion of the holomorphic Chern-Simons theory, appears here. In particular, this says that in the real case, if you vary your contour in a region where the field strength vanishes, then the Wilson loop doesn't change, at least as a classical operator. Here, if you vary the curve through a region where the bundle is holomorphic, or if the bundle is holomorphic when you vary the curve holomorphically, then the Wilson loop changes holomorphically. So delta bar here, remember that the BCFW shift depended on a complex parameter that I called R. This is just the anti-holomorphic derivative with respect to R, d by dr bar, if you will. Now, we can work out what this means, and that's what I'll explain next. But before we work out what it means, let's just think about what it's going to give us. You see, if we varied the contour of a Wilson loop in real Chern-Simons theory, then it's famous that computes a knot. If you compute the expectation value of a Wilson loop in real Chern-Simons theory, famously that gives you a knot invariant. It gives you something like the Jones invariant for SU2 and Wilson loop in the fundamental representation. So you can. If you were to take your Wilson loop in this real Chern-Simons theory and vary the contour, given that it's computing a knot invariant, you don't expect that your expectation value, the correlation function, will change as you vary this contour. That's a little bit naive. The reason it's naive is it may be that as you vary it, you cause part of the knot to cross through another part of the knot, so you change the type of the knot. So what will actually happen is that generically you'll find that there's no contribution from burying the Wilson loop. But there'll be extra contributions coming from when the Wilson loop cuts through each other. This is what happens in real transforms theory. Indeed, it gives a sort of poor man's derivation of the skein relations for the knot polynomial. We'll see that exactly the same thing happens in the twister case. And we can, there's a sort of parallel here between BCFW recursion for the scattering amplitude and the skein relations for knot invariants. I suppose I won't have too much time to say that. In any case, exactly what happens when you vary the Wilson loop, we found that we've got this expression. We now just sandwich this in terms of a correlation function, for the moment still just back in the holomorphic Chan-Simons theory. And we notice that this field strength that we pulled down is exactly the equations of motion of that Chan-Simons theory. So we replace this field strength by the variation of the Chan-Simons action. But then we integrate by parts in the path integral and bring this variation of the connection to act back on the Wilson loop, and you find that it just pulls down another power of the only way the only way this variation can get a non-zero contribution is if some point along the curve here that this is being integrated over coincides with the point where we inserted the field strength to begin with, because we're just varying it at point z. Okay. In other words, you only get a contribution if, as a consequence of your deformation, the Wilson loop is made to self-intersect. Okay. And then in the planar limit, what contribution do you get? Well, you just get the product of the two Wilson loops around this self-intersecting curve, something with a new intersection here. But in the planar limit, this product of the correlation function of Wilson loops factorizes and just becomes this correlation function of the product factorizes and becomes a product of the correlation functions. So if this thing was dual to an amplitude, then we're seeing that we're getting a factorization channel of the amplitude in the same way that Simon was suggesting, but now we're seeing it just coming out of the loop equations. Well, for precisely the BCFW deformation, it will always be the case that as you vary your line, it sweeps out of plane, and lines and planes in projective free space always intersect somewhere. So as you do the BCFW deformation, you will inevitably intersect at some point in this path, at some point in your deformation, you will inevitably intersect every other line in the Wilson loop. And so you get a sum of contributions from every other line in the Wilson loop. Again, these integrals are easy to do. We integrate over the BCFW parameter in the same way as for the amplitude, so we end up with three integrals, two around the curve, sort of one for where you're doing the variation, the other for where you might, where your intersection might be happening. and that together with the BCFW integration is saturated by this delta function. So it's a trivial integral to do. It again just pulls out one of these R invariants, and you get a factorization of the Wilson loop into two pieces. This is identically the tree-level BCFW recursion relation written in terms of momentum twisters from the point of view of the amplitude. It's actually, as Simon was explaining, it's important, though, to think of the full superamplitude, not n to the k MHV parts. There's no k in this formula directly. If you want to extract the recursion relation for a particular n to the k MHV, then you have to look at the homogeneity of this relation in terms of powers of the fermions. But the Wilson loop itself doesn't really care about k. It just cares about the full superamplitude. What I explained and went through here was just for the tree amplitudes, but so far we only used the Chern-Simons action. Remember, the full action for n equals 4 CPMLs had another term. It had this sum of MHV vertices or logarithmic derivative of the d-bar operator. If you put that back in, then when we do the integration by parts in the path integral here, we'll pick up a new term coming from when d by dA acts on this extra term in the action. And taking you can work through what that corresponds to, and taking account of that precisely modifies these tree-level BCFW recursion relations into the loop recursion relations, the recursion relations to the all-loop integrand. Okay, so let me just say a couple of words about correlation functions. So this is very much in its infancy, but we can also construct we've talked very much about on-shell observables. We've talked about scattering amplitudes. We've talked about Wilson loops. What about general correlation functions? Well, it's obvious that that's going to be a slightly more involved or interesting, depending on your point of view, object in twister space, precisely because although you had a local gauge invariant operator in space-time, this point in space-time becomes a non-local object. It becomes a Riemann sphere in twister space. And so just something nice and innocent like trace of phi squared suddenly becomes a double integral over this line, one for, sorry, these should be capital phis, one for each insertion point of these two phis. That's just coming from the Penrose transform, remember, that we saw right at the beginning. But if we're in a, if we're not in the abelian theory, if this thing carries some gauge indices, then we can't simply trace it to absorb the gauge indices on this side, precisely because these are inserted at different points on the Riemann sphere. We have to connect it up exactly with some sort of holomorphic frame or a holomorphic Wilson loop living on this Riemann sphere X, corresponding to the point X in space-time. One of the nice things about twister space, as we've seen, was how easily it handled the supersymmetry. In particular, if we want to obtain the expression not just for a particular member of a supermultiplet, but for a full supermultiplet, at least the chiral part of it, then it's instant. You just use exactly the supersymmetric Wilson loop defined in terms of the twister superfield as before, and you replace these fields here. If you want some scalars, you just replace it by the appropriate derivative of the original twister superfields. So the scalar sat in of order psi squared inside the superconnection. Now, so far we haven't really explored these correlation functions of these operators in much detail. You can see there's going to be a lot of interesting structure because as well as these bare fields, we also have an infinite number of fields waiting to be used along these Wilson lines. But that suggests that there is one limit which is very easy to look at, which is exactly the limit looked at by Korchemsky, Sokachev, and friends, where you take in space-time a bunch of operator insertions and consider a limit when they become null-separated. Considering the operators becoming null-separated in twister space just means that these twister lines, which before were disjoint when you had arbitrary points in space-time, are made to intersect. And you can show that, you know, just as always for like a light cone OPE, that these things, you know, the operators in space-time develop a Wilson line between them when they become null-separated. And that's sort of immediate in twister space because the Wilson line was already there just in defining what the operator was in the first place. In particular, if you look at the most singular part of this, at the level of the integrand, if you look at the most singular part of this correlation function in the limit that you take it null-separated, you find that all that can happen is that these fields on adjacent operators just contract with themselves, just joined up with propagators. And indeed, it turns out they actually get frozen to be at the intersection point. So the picture you end up with has once you factor out this singular piece, there's no record anymore of what the specific fields were, and you just have a Wilson line here in the adjoint, precisely because the original fields were in the adjoint. And then, so that much is the light cone OPE. But then, of course, because we've now got a Wilson line on a bunch of intersecting Riemann spheres in twister space, this, in the plane of limit, becomes equivalent to the scattering amplitude, except that because we've got the adjoint Wilson line, we now get the square of the scattering amplitude. It's sort of, in the plane of limit, two copies of the fundamental. So, again, the piece we brought to this story was just at the same time as some subset of these authors here, we also were able, using twister methods, to extend this duality between correlation functions and amplitudes to the full non-MHV, to the full superamplitude, where we consider correlators of chiral supermultiplets. Again, just as a sort of application of this fact that it's easy to consider supermultiplets in twister space, at least chiral ones. Okay, so I'll stop there, but I hope I've convinced you that there's now a lot of evidence for this correspondence between various objects, but in particular scattering amplitudes and null polygonal Wilson loops for the full superamplitude and some supersymmetric Wilson loops. In particular, we saw that if we do a perturbative computation in axial gauge, either for the scattering amplitudes themselves or for the Wilson loop, then diagram by diagram, these things correspond so long as you interpret the space-time of the scattering amplitudes to be where the space-time of the scattering amplitudes becomes the space-time of the Wilson loop. Sorry, that's a terribly badly. Where the region momentum space-time of the scattering amplitudes becomes the space-time of the Wilson loop. But further than that, we also saw that if you look at the loop equations, you get a rationale for why these Wilson loops should be obeying BCSW recursion relations. It's exactly the same story that Simon was pointing out in terms of factorization of the Wilson loops. So There are still many things to do. In particular, regularization is a very important issue, and we haven't yet addressed that. There's still lots of things we don't understand how to do with quantum field theory and twister space. But nonetheless, we're making progress, and I hope I've helped persuade you that twisters do provide some useful perspectives on various interesting problems in quantum field theory.
Thank you. Questions? No questions? So I think you did convince us then?
Everyone
okay.
wants lunch.
Let us thank David once more and go for that.